Okay. I did not know I didn't have to do a disclosure statement, so all the CME people, I have nothing to disclose. Trust me, I'm a pediatrician. Okay. All right. First of all, I know many of you already work with the Academy, but some of you aren't as familiar with sort of the background and mission statements of the Academy and how immunization sort of fit into this. So first of all, the Academy has a very broad mission that's about optimal health for children, infants, and adolescents, and young adults. We go up to 21 within the Academy, which has been an interesting dialogue now since there are people trying to get us to go to 24, but right now we're at 21 and holding. We also buy into or support the professional needs of our members, and we think that's really very important. I'll talk a little bit about how that relates also to immunizations. Our vision, again, is optimizing health and well-being, and also making sure our members deliver quality services but are also professionally satisfied with their status. And that, again, can sometimes be a very daunting mission. But I think the Academy, for the most part, is not the Academy of Pediatricians for them, but really we emphasize that we're the Academy of Pediatrics and very much do tremendous amount of advocacy. Some of you may know we have an office in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. People say, are you going to Chicago? I'm like, no, I'm going to Elk Grove Village. It's not Chicago. And they actually have real elk in Elk Grove Village. We also have a Washington office with about 30 to 35 people who do nothing but legislative advocacy. So it's really a major commitment for the Academy. This is the icon that expresses our agenda for children, and it basically outlines what our strategic priorities are each year. And this is our 2007-2008 strategic priorities. And as you can see here, immunizations are part of that, and we are in the implementation of phase of immunizations. And we have a task force. We also have a cooperative agreement with the CDC where we provide education for pediatricians. We provide technical assistance to help people monitor and increase their rates. Right now, we have a project that's going to focus on states with very low rates so that we can assist them. And in your state, you may be hearing more about that. We also have a website, which I'm going to give you the address for when I do the resource section. So immunizations are an important, critical element for pediatricians. You also see on this diagram, though, areas that don't vary on an annual basis. Healthcare equity is part of our universal principles, as is the profession of pediatrics, and the medical home, which I'm really going to emphasize in terms of the place where immunizations are really important. And then we have our pillars, which are access, which is our big, big issue, having survived the S-CHIP fight, and we're not giving up on S-CHIP, but certainly we did not get what we wanted. And we had so many collaborators in that, and I'm sure many of you know about that. But we will continue to look toward, you know, the elections and what candidates are going to bring in terms of universal access for children and for the general population. But our other issues are quality and also finance. The medical home. Many of you are very familiar with the medical home, but when we say that to people, sometimes they really sort of glaze over and try to figure out what in the world are you talking about. I know that over the time I've been doing this talks about the medical home, that I've finally been able to get it across to my husband, who is not a physician, okay? And he realized that his mother at 94, who was trying to get a hearing aid, and they weren't going to give it to her, he said, the problem is my mother does not have a medical home. So he understands, even for the geriatric level, medical home is an important concept. So what we're really talking about is this sort of approach that there is a centralized area or a centralized way that we deliver comprehensive care to the population. The medical home had started out as a sort of a pediatric concept, really sort of anchored in the special needs children approach. But we expanded that to all children, and now the adults, the internist and the family physicians are using the term medical home and actually devising ways that they can assess and possibly certify medical home. So it's really sort of mushroomed in terms of a concept. But it's an important concept in terms of where we can accomplish the health needs of our patients or our population, and very much in line with your theme for this year of healthier living. What can we say are the successes that have occurred so far as a result of really promoting this approach of the medical home? Certainly, patients and families are more satisfied because we think of it as a family-centered for pediatrics or patient-centered for the adult population. It's an area or an approach where there are people involved in problem solving for patients and families. We coordinate care, which has always been a key facet of the approach for the medical home, but it also means that there may be increased efficiency if we centralize these types of strategies. Limited resources are always our challenge, and so when we, again, centralize our approach, we use the limited resources we have more efficiently. Professionals are more satisfied working in this center because they understand and can identify community resources to bring to bear very often, and then it results in comprehensive care. But we also understand there are real challenges to the medical home in terms of the time that it really takes to pull these collaborators together to really do coordination, that systems aren't always responsive to the medical home approach, and there are real reimbursement issues related to medical home services, many of which, when we talk about coordination of care, are not well reimbursed. But how does the medical home then relate to immunizations? And I'm going to build a case here, and I'll start with evidence-based, because we all like that now. And there is an article I'll refer you to in Pediatrics 2005 that really looks for, especially at low-income children through the National Immunization Survey, and demonstrates that for VFC-eligible children, the rates are significantly higher for being up to date with vaccinations than they are with VFC-eligible children without a medical home. So again, looking at what is the impact of the medical home and making sure that immunizations are delivered in a timely and appropriate manner. But on the broader scale, what are we looking at when we say, what are immunizations really a part of, and what do they reflect about the public health system in the United States? And this is from the UNICEF study of child well-being in rich countries. And let's read it together. That a true measure of a nation's standing is how well it attends to its children, their health and safety, their material security, their education, socialization, and their sense of being loved, valued, and included in the families and societies into which they were born. And I emphasize this with a picture of my daughter and my new grandson. So you have to excuse me. I'm a proud grandma, okay? But, you know, it means a lot to us on a very, very personal level. In this study, UNICEF really looked at the six dimensions of child well-being, and health and safety was really a part of this, which relates to the message I'm trying to drive through about the medical home and primary and comprehensive care. So the six dimensions, that are, as you see, include that, but also include much broader dimensions of well-being. And I apologize for the size of this slide, but it doesn't take a lot of strain to see that the United States ranks 20 out of 21 for overall well-being. Now, what I really wish I could do is get the enthusiasm of this country to really be behind putting us up higher in this ranking and feeling as competitive about this as they could feel about these NCAA basketball championship. I mean, you know, people are really, you know, energized, but somehow this data hasn't gotten them energized yet, and we really need to figure out how we can do that. In addition to being number 20 out of 21, when you look at health and safety, and I hope you can see that, we're 21 out of 21, okay? Dead last. And what is included in the health and safety measures, immunization rates are included in that, but so is infant mortality, injuries to children, low birth weight rates. So these are all issues. This is part of the total public health kind of measure that we need to look at. So immunizations are part of it, but how can we really embed it in the comprehensive message about public health? So let's focus now on adolescent immunizations. And I know you're going to talk a lot about it, but I just borrowed from your data and put it on a slide about how we're doing with adolescent immunizations. And you can see we do fairly well with MMR and hepatitis B, but we have a great distance to go with meningococcal vaccine. And I know, as you know, that we all suffered from some of the challenges of having enough vaccine and availability of vaccine with meningococcal vaccine. So I'm sure that that really is part of the message with this data. But what are our successes? I think Anne has and her staff have done a wonderful job with really embedding the adolescent immunization campaign within the preventive health message for that preteen visit. That it's not just about the vaccines, but it's about almost vaccinating through counseling against some of the other challenges with adolescent health. We also, in that campaign, there was a focus on reducing disparity so that the materials are approaching all populations. And I think the use of some of the strategies to find out what should the messages be by using focus groups, by listening to our consumers about what is really going to appeal to them in terms of these immunization messages, I think was an important element of the development of the campaign. But unfortunately, the rates of preventive health for visits for adolescents are low. Especially if you compare them to younger children and even adults. There's a little, you know, sort of a divot in terms of the rates to that group. So that is something that we obviously have to work on together. The other successes are obviously the outcomes for MMR and hepatitis B. We all know that we need carrots in terms of our messages, but the school requirements are almost our stick because people really respond to that. And, you know, all of the pediatricians have had the experience at the beginning of school by about November when they figure out who's got immunized and who isn't, you start to get people with an emergency of getting in to get immunized. So, you know, it is really part of how we get people in, but it certainly isn't our optimal strategy, but it does work. We also recognize that there's a lot of work being done, and I'm sure you're going to talk about it in this meeting, about the successes that various states have had in raising their immunization rates. And it's important to share this kind of knowledge among states so that people can really figure out what are some of the approaches that might work for us. This is the poster that I really think is fantastic. And down here you see the message that I recommend that all 11 and 12-year-olds get a checkup to monitor their growth, talk about their development, and get their vaccine. So again, the packaging, the comprehensive approach, the understanding that it's not just the focus of immunization, but healthier living means that we've got to do some other things during that visit. So our actions in terms of meeting these challenges are providing reminder recalls for these visits, setting our protocols in our offices. And what I put down here was creating an expectation. You know, parents know that you go for the infant visits, for the infant developmental checks, for the infant other types of things, but they don't quite buy into this message that the preteens also need this visit. So we have to start creating this expectation that come back for the preteen visit. This is really an important visit for your child's development. And obviously assessing the vaccination, making sure we have no missed opportunities. One of my colleagues who has a huge practice in North Carolina says he uses the strategy of grab them and stab them. Now, I didn't think that was such a good idea or a good visual, but the idea is, I said, I think you're talking about missed opportunities. Okay, let's try to keep it a little bit better than that. So anyway, whatever lingo you use to do it, make sure people don't get away without having a chance to really look at those vaccine records and making sure we're not missing these opportunities. So in addition to what our successes have been around embedding it in the preteen visit, we've also been able to show with VFC and other access issues being resolved and doing this embedding that we're actually having an impact on the health disparities issue. I think the campaign has posters and materials available in Spanish, and I'm sure in some communities there need to be some additional languages added to that. I know in Washington we have a large Vietnamese population, so there, depending on the community you're part of, there are certainly ways to get the messages out in different languages. And certainly we, as I said before, Anne was aware of this when she started launching into the adolescent immunization campaign, and I think that's been looked at very successfully. Another strategy that most of you have used around trying to get the rates up are knowing who got immunized and who didn't by having strategies for immunization information systems or registries. And again, the registry is only as good as the cooperation you have by people making sure the data gets inputted. And one of our challenges has been that less than 50% on the last look at it of private providers are participating in the registries. So that is certainly one of the actions that we're going to need to take in terms of increasing physician participation. And states that have done well with that have to look to help states that haven't had as much success. Amazingly enough, in the District of Columbia, we get beat up about what we don't do all the time. We have a really lovely registry. And you know what it does that some of your registries probably do? Of all the things our members appreciate, it's printing out those school forms without having to fill them in every year. They think that is the greatest thing since sliced bread. So our immunization registry, people are in love with it. But what we don't do still is get as much data in there for our kids that are insured by private payers. So we still have a ways to go, but I'll tell you that school form did it in terms of people really getting invested in participating in the registry. So, you know, trying to understand what the climate is for your pediatricians or your family practitioners, whomever your providers are of the medical home for children and adolescents, to really think about really how to do things that really make it more reasonable for them to deliver this care. Vaccine financing for pediatricians has been a real target, and the Academy has really been out front trying to help its members with overcoming some of these issues. As you can see, part of it has to do with the science of vaccines and the fact that in 1985 we were down at $45 to $115 for vaccines, and now we're really up to almost $1,700. Just as sort of a personal look at this, when I went into adolescent medicine 30 plus years ago, we're not going to say how many additional years, but 30 plus years, I thought, oh man, I took my boards, I don't have to know anything else about immunization schedules, I'm on to these other things. Okay, aha, you know, here I am on irony being on the campaign with Ann talking about immunization. So the science changes things in a good way. We also don't see many of the vaccine-related diseases that we saw when I started into practice. So this is a good story in many ways, but the impact of it is truly a financial impact that we need to deal with. And we see here in a graphic form, this is what the cost looked like in 1980, and this is what the cost looks like now. And this is the Gardasil piece of that cost. So this is a tremendous difference in terms of vaccine financing. I'm sure the challenge at the state level, but also the challenge for the practitioner or the person in the medical home who delivers the vaccines. One of the messages also is about vaccine administration in addition to the cost of the vaccine. And what this demonstrates, each one of these little lines is a state. And this line is what the caps were on the cost for vaccine administration back in 1994. Okay? So you see some states are not anywhere near what the vaccine cap rate is in that state. And to bring it home and to have you think about it, how would you like your paycheck to really reflect in 2006 what it reflected in 1994? I don't think that would be a good feeling for you. You know, we won't even talk about issues of gas and bread and milk, but certainly just conceptualizing where we were in 94 and where we are now, and the cost to really being a part of a practice has really escalated, and these rates have not kept up with that. So that is a real issue for many of the members of the Academy who do office-based practice. So what do we need to look at in terms of the successes that have occurred? That there have been, in some states, increased rates of payment to private payers and also to private insurance, as well as the rates for the reimbursement for giving vaccines. We're able to now devise a business case for how much vaccines actually cost to administer in the office setting, because again, the challenge is to be evidence-based. You can't just say we need more money, but what are you really basing this on? And that's an important message. But the challenge, as you saw in that graph, is that administration fees in many states are nowhere near the cap, and we need to do some corrective action to that. So advocacy is a really big part of the action agenda for issues related to financing. And one of the last messages that have really impacted the Academy is the immunization messaging. I don't know how many of you are aware that we sort of got out there in terms of messaging that we were concerned about that was occurring in the media with the Eli Stone show. I'm not a TV person, and I didn't even know who Eli Stone was, but now, boy, do I know who he is. And the messaging about vaccine risk and the lack of vaccine safety, that was a really big issue that called to our attention how much we need to help our members with messaging around vaccines. Certainly the CDC information sheets that we give patients are really important, but I think now we're being challenged to deliver more messages and more complex messages about some of these vaccines. So I think the issue of health literacy, the information we have, do we really express it in a way that people can understand at their reading level? And how have we done enough with the public education campaign, with the media and other contemporary methods? Our younger people who need these messages do not want brochures, and they don't even want to go to websites. They want to see it in their contemporary methodology, MySpace, and you know, can some of these other ways that kids get messages be used in a positive way to take some of our vaccine and health messages to these young people? I think that's a challenge for us, but I think it's one we really need to address. So let me offer our resources at the Academy. The Academy main website, which now has on the front page a information section on vaccines and autism, because that's been our latest challenge for our members. But we also have a general immunization page for support for clinicians. And then Bright Futures, our third edition of Bright Futures just came out in October, which really looks at what some of the preventive health visits ought to contain for all children and adolescents. So I hope that the message I'm trying to deliver to you today has to do with certainly the beneficial approach to looking at how to optimize health in general, to keep with your theme of healthier living, working, we hope, in the medical home, but that also pediatricians are enthusiastic collaborators in accomplishing your immunization goals. In many states, you already have your pediatricians working with you. We have 66 state chapters. There's a state chapter that can work with you around this, and we really want to do that, because I think together we can commit to removing these barriers and overcoming the challenges, because they're so important that we do this job for children and for the families that we serve. Thank you so much for your attention.